So good evening and welcome to the Swiss National Museum. And we also have Julia online. I think if she hears us, then she can also join. Welcome to the second evening inside the series of History Talks. Today we will talk about endangered cultural heritage. You might ask why we want to talk about cultural heritage in danger when at the same time war threatens so many people and their lives. With the annexation of four Ukrainian territories by Russia and the mobilization in Russia, the situation has lately become even more dramatic than before. We have decided to hold this discussion today anyway, because as the Council of Europe framework Convention on the Value of Cultural Heritage for Society states, heritage is a resource for human development, the enhancement of cultural diversity, and the promotion of intercultural dialogue. So knowledge and use of heritage from part of the is part of the citizen's right to participate in cultural life as defined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And when cultural heritage is endangered or destroyed, it has a drastic impact on entire populations, their culture, their legacy. The attacks on cultural heritage in recent years are considered the most serious since the Second World War. They concern both movable and immovable cultural goods and also intangible cultural heritage. And in armed conflicts, the destruction of cultural heritage is no longer collateral damage. Cultural assets are deliberately attacked and are tactical targets. But there is not only war. The increase in extreme meteorological events is also a substantial threat to the existence and preservation of cultural heritage. As Swiss National Museum, we preserve and conserve, with around 870,000 objects, important cultural assets for our society. So cultural heritage is a topic that is kind of our everyday life. It's very important to our everyday work as a museum. And in a world where cultural heritage is increasingly under threat, we want to contribute this evening by discussing about it and by raising awareness about an issue that affects all of us. Good evening, Julia. Now we see you.
Hello.
I will present you in a couple of minutes. It is a great pleasure that I can now introduce to you my guest. I start here in the room with Maria Jose Miñana. She holds a master's degree in art history from the University of Barcelona and a master's degree in cultural studies from the University of Edinburgh. She has been working in the UNESCO program dedicated to the fight against illicit trafficking in cultural property since 2010, where she is in charge of assisting member states in developing technical capacities to protect movable cultural heritage, strengthening advocacy efforts and building partnerships to reinforce cooperation in this field. Welcome to Zurich, Maria. Then on the program, you have seen the name of Benno Widmer. Benno Widmer is head of the Museums and Collections section of the Federal Office of Culture here in Switzerland. He unfortunately cannot be here today, but we have the chance to have Tania Esposito with us instead, deputy head of the specialized service for the transfer of cultural property at the Federal Office of Culture here in Switzerland. She studied law at Zurich University, has worked as an attorney, and also has a master in arts management. She has been working in the field of cultural property law for the past 12 years. Welcome also to you, Tania. And now online, I very warmly welcome Julia Vaganova. I'm very, very thankful that it is possible for you to join us this evening. Thank you very much. Julia Vaganova is art historian, art manager and curator. She previously worked at the Mitsuzeki Arsenal as deputy director for exhibition and museum projects and as director of the Center for Contemporary Art at Naukma in Kiev. From 2013 to 2016, she was the deputy director of exhibitions and partnerships at the National Art Museum of Ukraine. She contributed in these institutions to the development and implementation of strategies and initiated and directed a number of trainings focused on the development of art institutions and site-specific art activities. Today, she is the acting director of the Bohdan and Varvara Kanenko National Museum in Kiev. Welcome also to you, Julia. We will speak here on the panel for around 1 hour. Afterwards, there will be time for your questions. We will try to understand together what cultural heritage means and what it does to the people who lose it. And at the same time, we will look at concrete situations on the field and especially at the current situation in Ukraine. I would like to start with a question for all of you. What does cultural heritage embody for people, populations, and communities? Why is cultural heritage so important? Who wants to start? Maria?
Sorry. First of all, thank you so much, Denise, and thank you to the National Museum of Switzerland for inviting UNESCO to this talk. I'm very happy to be here with you tonight. You're asking what the cultural heritage means for our communities, for the peoples. I would say that cultural heritage reflects the history and identity of communities, and it's transmitted from generation to generation. And precisely because of this, because of the link between cultural heritage and identity, it is so tragic that it's destroyed, intentionally destroyed. I would say that the protection of cultural heritage is even an ethical necessity, but there is also an aspect of cultural heritage which is maybe sometimes forgotten, and it's the potential of cultural heritage for the recovery of societies after a crisis. This is something which was tackled in the meeting of cultural ministers in 2021 in Rome. In the declaration that they adopted, they really underline the role of cultural heritage for the regeneration of economy and societies after a crisis. And in this context, UNESCO has a normative framework for the protection of cultural heritage from all its aspects, from built heritage, movable cultural heritage, intangible heritage, underwater heritage, even for the protection of the diversity of cultural expressions too, and a convention which is focused on the protection of cultural heritage in the event of armed conflict, which of course now is very much relevant, unfortunately. Maybe Tania wants to follow.
Sure. Oh. So thank you so much. And also thank you for having me instead of Benno Widmer. So I tried to do my best from a little bit, maybe more from my perspective than from his. But concerning your question and the words of Maria Mignana, so I totally agree, of course, what you are saying. So maybe just to complete or to add on this, from our perspective as Federal Office of Culture, so this unique value of cultural heritage, this is why the protecting, preserving, and promoting of cultural heritage today is a duty also of the state. This is why the state has to take care of it as well. And also maybe a bit in the context now with Ukraine, I mean, in the context of war, cultural heritage can also be used as a strategic tool, of course, like if you, as the destruction has, as you said, like this is really a symbolic impact and symbolic power, so to destabilize communities and people. So So this is why it is so important that to keep it. So I like to call it it's kind of the tissue or the fabric of the society that sort of knits everything together. So, yeah.
Thank you, Julia. You are in a completely different situation. Maybe, yeah, your words to that.
Thank you, first of all, for inviting me, and thank you for organization of this very important discussion, which is very important for Ukraine now. Of course, I will join to the speakers, and I agree with what was told by Maria and Tanya. I will also would like to add from my side that for all of us now, especially when we have a lot of damages of the cultural heritage, we are talking about the heritage like a place of the stability. This is something which you could refer yourself and which you could make the self-discovery and self-identification when you have this refer point. So that's why this cultural heritage is so important for us. If we will go further and to talk about the cultural heritage and what it will give us, I would add that actually this is a place of interaction of different cultures, because you don't have the local heritage, you don't have only isolated cultural heritage. It's all the time interaction between different cultures. And such an interaction gives us the possibility for the development and for the enrichment of your culture, my culture, and all culture. So that's why when we have gap somewhere, it means that we lose something. That's why the cultural heritage of all the countries is very important for our common development.
Thank you very much. So identity, connection, cultural heritage really is important for cultures, for people, for legacies. Maria, the next question is for you. One of the main tasks of UNESCO is to protect cultural heritage in danger or in emergency situations. What endangers today cultural heritage? It is not only war.
Well, thank you for this question. In emergency situations, cultural heritage is particularly at risk because of its fragility and also because it's a symbolic value. And this is the reason why UNESCO works with the international community to protect cultural heritage in these kind of situations, which can be caused by armed conflict, but also by natural disasters. When it comes to armed conflict, you may remember that, unfortunately, in recent conflicts, for instance, in Syria, you may remember the destruction of Palmyra, you may also remember the looting of the National Museum of Iraq in Baghdad, you may also remember the destruction of manuscripts and mausoleums in Mali, and also what is happening right now in Ukraine. Culture is very often targeted during armed conflicts. And this is why UNESCO really pushed further adoption by the Security Council of the United Nations of two resolutions. The first one in 2015, resolution 2199, which focuses on the protection of cultural heritage in Syria and Iraq. This resolution imposed a ban on cultural heritage originating from Iraq and Syria, and also highlighted the links between the illicit trafficking of cultural property and the financing of terrorism. Then there is also another resolution adopted in 2347, which is the only resolution from the Security Council which is specially focused on the protection of cultural heritage in armed conflict. So this is really important for the international framework for the protection of cultural property. At the same time, besides the damage to cultural heritage caused by armed conflicts, there is also the damage caused by natural disasters such as floods, earthquakes, hurricanes. Just a few days ago, what happened in Pakistan because of the floods, many cultural heritage sites, museums, archaeological sites were severely damaged. So in this context, UNESCO also created what we call the Heritage Emergency Fund, which is a funding mechanism to enable states to act rapidly to protect heritage in this kind of situations. Right now, precisely, there's been a request from Pakistan to use this Heritage Emergency Fund to rescue endangered heritage because of the flood. So this is why protecting heritage in an emergency situation is so important for UNESCO. It's one of our priorities because we know what is at stake. We know the importance of cultural heritage for the recovery of the communities after a crisis.
Maria, here we are really in the middle now of what is being destroyed, of what is endangered. And Julia, when I was in Prague last August and I had the possibility to meet the Deputy Minister of Culture in Ukraine, Katerina Chuyeva, she spoke about hundreds of endangered and already destroyed buildings and monuments and sites in Ukraine. Could you tell us a little bit more in detail? You have mentioned a couple of things before. Could you tell us how the situation is right now in the Ukraine?
Yes, the Ministry of the Culture runs a special website where you can see online the all fixed damages of the cultural institutions. You can find this website in both languages, as Ukrainian and English as well, and now it fixed more than 500 damages of the cultural institutions. It includes museums, churches, historical buildings. So actually, this is a number which now you could officially find on the website of the Ministry of the Culture. The problem is that part of the institutions which are or other institutions which are not damaged physically, they're every day under the attack. So you don't know what will be the next hit. And this is the most and the biggest problem for the all cultural institutions and museums, because it's unpredictable, unfortunately, and it's impossible to be ready for such a missile attack. Part of the institutions, of course, trying, not part, but all institutions are caring about their collections and trying to prevent and somehow to save this collection. But of course, you could easily imagine that you cannot just move all collection in one place, or you cannot just hide all collections somewhere in the bunker because it just doesn't exist in the countries. And I'm pretty sure that it doesn't exist in other countries as well. I remember that I was talking with my colleagues from Berlin, and they told me that actually they don't have a protocol for such an event. And they don't know also what to do in case of such a, of the war, or if museums will be under the attack. So part of the institutions now more or less, they're not bombed. They have buildings, they have collections, or they save the collection. But now we see and we face the situation before the winter of the so-called second damages of the collection, because collections which moved or which are trying to be saved in more safe places, very often these places are not ready for such a collection. And you cannot prevent and you cannot predict, what will be with the heating and with the electricity. So unfortunately, this will be the next challenge for all of Ukrainian museums and restorators, what to do during the winter and what to do after the winter. And the last but not the least, of course, it's the team, it's the people, because there are people who are working in these museums, and some of them are working really in the very dangerous situation. For example, there are museum colleagues who are working in Kharkiv, which is under attack every day. But also there are another team who are divided and who will face the big challenge after the war and during the war to be reconnected and to find their jobs again and to find the sense of their jobs. So this is the situation if we're talking about the institutions which are in damage. At the same time, you mentioned about the cultural heritage and cultural institution as a place of the stability and recovering. And really we see now the big request from the audiences to come to the museum because they're really looking in the museum, the place for the recovery and place of the stability. Unfortunately, almost all museums dismounted their expositions, so they have to find out the ways how to work in this situation in another way. Sometimes they never worked in this way, but nevertheless, they're finding the new projects and new activities and reinvent themselves. So trying to use this time also to analyze the activity and the institutional practices and policies. For example, Hanenka Museum ran the exhibition of contemporary art, which never was done in the walls of the instant exposition. Or just yesterday, sorry, 2 days ago, we ran the absolutely new and contemporary opera for the visitors, which was run in all our empty rooms by the very perfect and very great musician, which calls Opera Aperta. It calls Genesis, and it was about the memory.
Thank you very much for this very detailed insight, and I really thank you for having mentioned that the audience has really this need now to go back to the museums and to see the cultural heritage. And we see that also in the case, for example, of Syria, in many refugee camps, and so that people really have this need to connect to their culture and to their history. So this really shows how important it is. And I would like to mention here for the audience here, and also because I'm from the Italian part of Switzerland, that during the great waves of emigration in Switzerland from in the 18th and 19th century, we had many Swiss people emigrated to the region also now being part of Ukraine, and architects from Ticino, so from the south part of Switzerland, for instance, designed some of the most important buildings in Odessa. And from its founding in 1794, the work of the Swiss architects have given the city a Mediterranean flair. And just to mention one example, the Stock Exchange building in Odessa, now the town hall, was built by Francesco Boffa and Giorgio Torricelli around 1900. And I say this because even if we may think that cultural heritage in Ukraine has maybe not so much to do with us, it is not like this. It has very much to do also with us. And it is like this in many different countries, because as also you mentioned very well, Julia, cultural heritage is connected to many different things. And this is for me really one very important example to realize that actually in the Ukraine we have different buildings that have very much to do also with Switzerland, or at least with the region of Switzerland where I come from. So I have now, my next question is again for you all. What does cultural heritage mean to the people who lose it? What are your experiences in the areas really where you work and in your field? Maybe we could start again by Maria.
First of all, I would like to thank you again underlining the fact that cultural heritage is the cultural heritage of humanity, not only of the country or the state where it finds itself, but it's really our common heritage. To respond to your question, Denise, in fact, I would like to rather focus on what happens when the community recovers the cultural heritage after its loss. And I was thinking about this quite a speaking example of the Stela number 9 of the archaeological site of Piedras Negras in Guatemala. It's an archaeological site which was looted and illegally excavated in the 60s. And then the Stela number 9 appeared in an auction in Paris in 2019. And then thanks to the efforts of Guatemala, of UNESCO, and also to the efforts of France and the private collector, there was a ceremony of restitution, of voluntary handover of the Stela back to Guatemala. And now the Stela finds itself back in the Museum of Archaeology and Ethnology of Guatemala. Now the community can enjoy again part of its past, can also enjoy part of its future because it's part of it. So I wanted to maybe to explain what the loss means by explaining how the recovery was, because it's very important for objects to for some objects of extremely importance for the communities of origin to be back in their original settlement. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this, Tanya. Julia, you want to add something?
I just want to make a little reply to Julia's comment before, and I just wanted to thank you, like, also for sharing with us, like, these activities that you do in this situation, that you're like telling that you're trying to find these new ways, because I'm really in awe what you do, because this is really, it's really amazing, because we are sitting here and in this safe surroundings, and I just wanted to thank you for also this sharing this with us. And coming back to the question, Maria stole a little bit my answer, because I was also thinking about, okay, what does it mean to lose something and what does it mean to get it back? And from my experience, from what we do at in our specialized service, one of our tasks is actually to do restitutions of cultural property to the countries of origin. And we have like these two types. This one is like these official restitutions. This is from criminal proceedings when an cultural property has been confiscated, and then the Switzerland, it goes to the state, and then we return it to the country of origin. But there is also the case, and we see it more and more, that we have people, private people or institutions, museums, collections, that come to us on a free base, voluntary, and say, oh, I have something in my collection. I inherited something from my grandfather, and I was thinking about it, and maybe it wasn't okay. It's not okay that I still keep it. I think I want to give it back to the country of origin. And in these cases, we are responsible to get in touch, or we sort of serve as an intermediator between the countries and these private people. And we contact first the embassies. And there, what you notice, we don't restitute always this really high-end object. It's not like always Nofretete. Sometimes it's just a small, maybe pre-Columbian terracotta vase or something like this. But it doesn't really matter what it is, because what matters is really the act to do it, and it's always met with so much pleasure and with so much we've never had the case that somebody said, no, we don't want it because it's just a tiny little thing that somebody maybe sold on eBay for 200 Swiss francs, but they're always very appreciative, and it always starts the dialogue also, and this is, I think, is very interesting, and what is also nice that we see when we have these private initiatives, that you see that maybe the mindset has also changed in the last couple of years, the last 20 years, that maybe people start to think, okay, what do I have and where does it come from? So people start questioning, where does it come from and how has it maybe left the country that it comes from? So this is something. So also, like, this perspective that when you get it back, you see how they react and how much it is appreciated. So, yeah.
Thank you very much. Julia, you are confronted with it now every day. What does cultural heritage mean to people who lose it?
Well, for some people, of course, for all of us, as you mentioned about the restitution, of course, it's a demand of justice. Because when you lose something, you feel that it's not a gift, yes, and you would like to get it back. And until we will have no reaction on such a situation, when, for example, Russian museums stealing the collection from the Ukraine, and there are also actually ICOM members taking part in it. Unfortunately, the situation will not change. Because there is no reaction, and after the 2014, unfortunately, the Russian Museum were in cooperation with many other museums, in spite of moving the heritage from the Crimean. But if we will go deeper in this question about the what it means for the people who lose it, if we will go not for the one-day moment, but trying to analyze, for example, 10, 20, 30 years, what is going on. When you destroy and when you lose your heritage, it somehow erases some part of your memory, of the memory of your country. And actually the erasing, total erasing the cultural heritage in Ukraine, what is now actually going on, this is one of the ways to erase the memory of the culture and of the people. And this is, when you erase the memory, of course, it's always the empty place, and this is unfilled. And in the case, and this is the case of the great manipulation of the people who has this gap in the memory, because this gap started to be filled with some other stories. But the stories, unfortunately, not yours. So that's why you don't feel yourself, you don't know your root, and you don't feel that this is your story. And in fact, this is a story that's foreign to you. You are confused, and you are, have no support, and easily manipulated, because there is no anchor to your heritage, and there is no anchor to the history. So this actually means to the people who are lost the heritage, if we will see in perspective of 10, 20 years. And to avoid this, of course, this is a question not to give, to destroy the heritage, and to have the reaction on such a movement, or to have the reaction on such an action from the aggressor.
Thank you very much for sharing this with us, Julia. And we will come back in the end to this question of erasing memory and when. What can we do when cultural heritage is really destroyed? Then you cannot give it back. And when it's really destroyed, yeah, what? How can we give it back to a community, to a culture, to a population? We will come back to it towards the end of our discussion. Now I would like to address another topic, and I maybe start with you, Tanya, because the Federal Office of Culture has a lot to do with that, and we are confronted with it also at the borders of Switzerland. In this situation, in situation of war especially, one of the main threats for cultural heritage is illicit import. So there are people that are trying to make a profit of it. Import, export, and transfer of ownership of cultural property. Since 1970, many countries try to implement the Convention on measures to prohibit and prevent the illicit import, export, and transfer of ownership of cultural property. Switzerland is also part of these countries, but we know that organized criminal groups are increasingly involved in trafficking cultural property, both through legitimate markets, but also through the internet and in underground illicit markets. Trafficking in cultural property had also been recently identified as a possible source of financing for terrorist groups. What does illicit trafficking imply? Which instruments are in place to recognize and prevent illicit trafficking? And yes, maybe Tanya, what is the situation in Switzerland? What can we do as a country to prevent illicit trafficking?
Yes, thank you so for the question. So maybe I want just to take a little step back, if I may, just to talk about this looting and illicit trafficking and maybe and how they are connected, because it is actually, unfortunately, a very old story, because it has happened, the looting and the trafficking has happened for forever, I could say. So this is actually an old phenomenon, also always in connection with war, of course. There it's just that goes hand in hand. But also today it is like especially source countries are being affected by looting on a massive scale. And so I'm talking about Latin America, Southeast Asia, Africa, countries like Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, and of course now Ukraine, like very recent. So this is, it is not only, the reasons is not only, of course, one part of it is always like conflicts, it's armed conflicts, unstable political situations, but the other part is also lack of resources, because maybe you are not able to protect and secure museums, churches, archaeological sites. So this is also one of the problematics. And of course, another one, and this is rather on our side, is there is a demand for objects. So this is all the sites. And maybe it's also worth mentioning, if I may, if we have the time, that I want to address just the objects that are particularly at risk. So what kind of topic, what kind of objects are being trafficked? And one of the very sensitive groups of objects that are being at risk of being trafficked is the group of archaeological objects. So this is also one of the targets that we are working with. This is also a target like of UNESCO, because this is a group of objects. I mean, also by their nature, I mean, these objects are hidden in the ground, so nobody really knows they exist, or the owner, like, and in most source countries, they have laws that the owner is the state, so they don't know that they are here, and they are not in inventories, so they're very, it's very difficult to trace them, so that makes them very untraceable, like, afterwards, like, when you ask about provenance. So this is... so this is a group of objects that are very targeted by this illicit trafficking. And of course, another problematic with archaeological objects is not only that you lose this nice object, which is maybe valuable and is very nice, but you destroy like the context around it. So this object has no history. It is very nice, maybe brings nice money, but... it has no history, and by excavating illegally, which is not done professionally, of course, the whole context around the object where it has been excavated is also destroyed. So, like, you lose, like, on so many, in so many ways, you lose the context and also this part of history. So this is why these objects are very, very vulnerable. So this and also very targeted. Also, another point, you raised it, which is something that is with an old phenomenon, it's not an old phenomenon, but new with the old phenomenon, but is a real catalyst, is of course the internet. And this is something that really, I think, changed in the last, I don't know, maybe 10 to 15 years. So this is something that also, like, international organizations like Interpol, like they identify this as this really, really big problem, that it's online market platforms, of course, but also social media. When social media has become really a facilitator for the expansion of antiquities trafficking networks. And there have been studies, this is very interesting, so this, that since 2011, when the Arab Spring happened, that the Arab Spring really served as kind of also as a catalyst for social media growth across like certain regions like North Africa and the Middle East. Of course, then it was for a different purpose, but this kind of growth and this reach of this social, of these platforms have since been used and capitalized by criminal groups and terrorists as a result in the end, like it's that they have like a digital trade black market for any kind of objects. I'm not only talking about cultural property, but of course drugs, arms, etc. So this is really a growing problem, and it also shifted a bit the channels where objects are being gone through. So they don't have to go through an antiquities dealer anymore with his shop somewhere. So it's really, you can just surf around in your social media groups with like-minded people and you just connect directly. So this is really seen as a really big problem. And I think until now it has not been really solved. So it's I think you probably agree, Maria.
Maria, yes, maybe you want to add something, because illicit trafficking is really a part of your main work that you do at UNESCO.
Well, thank you, Tania, because I think that you really you tackle many of the issues that I'm going to underline right now. You also mentioned the problem with the archaeological objects. Indeed, this is one of our main concerns, because for their very nature, they are not part of an inventory, so it's really difficult to trace them back. And also, the illicit trafficking of archaeological objects really represents a problem for scientific research, because, of course, objects are outside of their context. So it really has very detrimental consequences for the protection of cultural heritage, for scientific research, and, of course, for the identity of the peoples of origin. What I would like to say is that UNESCO really assists its member states in the implementation of the 1970 Convention that Denise just mentioned. How do we support states? We do support states through capacity building, through technical advice, and through the development of tools. The convention has now 132 states which have ratified. Switzerland has ratified, and also it's a very active state when it comes to supporting UNESCO financially also in its program. So thank you very much for all the support these last years. You already mentioned, Denise, that that illicit trafficking is linked to the financing of terrorism, to money laundering, to organized crime. This is why UNESCO, we really work together with our partners in the field, like Interpol, like UNODC, which is the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, also with ICOM. And we work very closely, too, with law enforcement at the national level, with police, with customs. We do organize trainings so that they know all the tools which are at their disposal. And, of course, we do have the problem of the increase in illicit trafficking due to internet and social media. It's quite a new phenomenon, meaning that it's been, as you say, maybe 10 years, that it's really aggravating. There is, with Interpol, we drafted already 10 years ago the basic actions to stop illicit trafficking on the internet, but probably we'll have to update them because now it's exploded, of course. And it's really terrifying because even on YouTube you can find tutorials on how to use metal detectors in archaeological sites. So it's really out of control, and from UNESCO and with our partners we're trying to do our best to tackle this problem. Also, in the last 2-3 years of the COVID pandemic, many archaeological sites and museums were not surveilled, so we have seen an increase in the illicit trafficking of cultural property, which is our concern. How do we support states in implementing the convention? So we really focus on the development of preventive measures, because we know that prevention is key to protecting cultural heritage. For instance, we support states in the development of inventories. We also support them in the creation and training of police forces, of customs forces specialized in the protection of cultural property. We also give a lot of importance, this is really key, to the development of laws for the protection of cultural heritage. In this regard, UNESCO has a database on national cultural heritage laws, which has over 3,000 laws from all over the world. Is a really interesting tool for researchers, for law enforcement agencies to know more about how to go about the restitution procedure, for instance. And we are also trying to come up with a set of model provisions on the prevention and fight against illicit trafficking of cultural property, so that states could adapt these model provisions into the national law. We are also giving a lot of importance to the to awareness raising, because, as you said before, anyone can buy now an object on the internet. You don't need to be a professional collector. You can just bump into an interesting object on eBay, purchase it. You may not have a clue of where it comes from. So it's really out of control, very much to our regret. So that this is why we launch communication campaigns for the general public, just to for people to know the value of heritage. It's not only about the monetary value, it's about the symbolic value too. And last but not least, we are really trying to cooperate more and more with the art markets, because they are key, of course, well, to combat illicit trafficking and cultural property. So we are trying to revise the code of ethics for dealers in cultural property in close cooperation with the art market, in order to strengthen due diligence and ethical principles when it comes to the market of antiquities, especially antiquities.
Thank you very much. Julia, are you confronted as a director at your museum directly with illicit trafficking already, or how is the topic, can you sense it? Do you have an idea of what is really in danger? How is the situation in Ukraine?
I think that Maria and Tanya actually explained very good that the biggest danger, of course, is the archaeological site, because when you destroy the archaeological site, it started to be useless for the historical sense of meaning, because I cannot then to make the research on the site. And of course, these small objects, it's really very very easy to take and very easy to transport. I'm in group of the which is actually organized by Ukrainian ICOM, and I'm also in this group. We have prepared the red list, and actually it's almost ready, and it's a little bit a small some editing has to be done there, but we are preparing red list about the Ukrainian heritage, what could be actually go to the market and what could be most interesting and maybe available for such a market. So this is what we are doing right now, and trying actually also to monitor what is what are the ways where this object could move, because there are actually two ways, two ways. One, of course, with the people who are going from the Ukraine to the West, it's also possible. Another one, of course, it's on the East via Russia. And Belarus also, mostly now from through the Russia. And if we're talking about the personal, I mean, about the people who could transport by themselves the archaeological things or icons or some treasures and so on. So on the West, so in the East, there are also big traffic, which actually a lot of things which taken by the Russian troops, and it's under the control. And also, as I mentioned before, some of the objects and some of the museums, actually the artworks from the museums were moved officially, and it's you could find that in internet. This is confirmation on the about it of Russian army. So this, I think, will be the next way where this traffic is going on, and this will be the next question about the restitution, when the things are going not only for the market but also in Russian museum, and the question of the restitution.
Thank you very much. In hearing all this, the question that arises is, what can we do from here? What can we do as Switzerland? And maybe Tanya, yes, what can we do in Switzerland? What can the Federal Office of Culture do concretely to help preserve and protect endangered cultural heritage in general, and in particular now in the case of the Ukraine? And what can maybe people just everyday, you know, in everyday life do to protect cultural heritage?
I think one of the things, and this is what I didn't mention before, is that what you need, of course, is a legal framework. That this is called as a basis. That concerned the illicit to prevent illicit trafficking of cultural property. And Switzerland has implemented the UNESCO Convention of 1970 in 2005, and since then, Switzerland, we have this is a law. It's the Cultural Property Transfer Act, Kulturgütertransfergesetz, and it regulates the import of cultural property, transit, export, and the transfer, any kind of transfer of cultural property, and has measures against the illicit transfer. And just to maybe explain very quickly what it means. So it is, it means this law actually, because so this was in the end a political decision, because Switzerland is a market country. It has a very important art trade. So the solution was not to say there is no more art trade allowed. So what the law is trying to do is actually, it says, okay, but there are rules if you transfer cultural properties. So you can buy them, you can sell them, you can import them, but you need to stick to the rules. And what is forbidden is actually to import or buy and sell and transfer a stolen cultural property or a cultural property that has been looted. And if you do this, like if an object that has been, for instance, illegally excavated in Ukraine is being imported into Switzerland, so this will be criminally sanctioned. So this is a criminal act. What there is also, what the law also introduced is that you have to, every cultural property, if legal or illegal, is being imported into Switzerland, that you have to declare it at the customs, because the customs is actually, Maria mentioned it before, because it's the frontier is the entry port into a country. Once it is inside, it's just inside, it's just somewhere. So actually what the law asks is that every cultural property that enters into Switzerland has to be declared at the border. If you don't do it, even if your object is legal, it has a totally legal background, it is criminally sanctioned. So this is kind of the legal framework that is here. So and this is and that is being executed. And to your question, so what can we do, and specifically Federal Office of Culture, which is charged with execution of this law, and in particular in the case of Ukraine. So what can be done and what has been done since February of this year? So as I mentioned, like there is laws that are already in place. Very important is the collaboration with customs. And since March this year, so like there have been done some risk assessments and risk profiles for the customs regarding cultural property from Ukraine. So like the customs, so they know that they what they have to look for. So like there's also a cultural property coming also from, not only from Ukraine, of course, but also from Russia, from Belarus and all the Belarus and the neighboring countries. So these are targeted, as we say, like as risk risk countries or risk profiles. So this is something, a very important work. Maria mentioned this very important tool, which is the Red List by ICOM. A Red List is basically a list of very threatened types of cultural property that is being at risk for being illicitly trafficked, and we are very much waiting for it to come out, because this is a tool also the customs can use, because if they have a list of types of objects that they have to look out for, this is very important, because you know a customs official, and Zöllner, I mean, how does he know if this is a Ukrainian cultural property? I mean, this is so difficult. And of course, the custom doesn't have the focus on cultural property. They have to focus like on all so many stuff. So this is very important that we have these tools to teach them also sort of how to recognize something and to react and to stop. And then it stopped, and then we see further what it is actually. In the sense maybe of rapid response, I don't know if you want me to...
1 minute?
Okay. What has also been done, because we've been doing a lot of things also since March, there has also been a very tight collaboration with VMS, this is Verein der Museen Schweiz, where the Federal Office of Culture has allocated the budget for a purpose to commission VMS to coordinate like the Swiss support for actions in Ukrainian museums. And this has been a very fruitful collaboration. They have been able to really I cannot talk for them, but just very quickly that they to extend and build up this network with other networks in Germany, to really go to the museums in Ukraine to ask them, what do you need? And from there, we have been able to support with financial assistance many, many projects of transportation of protection material for museums. I mean, it's really basic, actually, like fire extinguisher and just materials and to store and preserve the objects on place. So this has been. So we have actually the Federal Office of Culture has designated in March like 750,000 francs for financial assistance for this kind of projects, for the purpose to safeguard the Ukrainian cultural heritage. And until now, we've had 9 projects in place, many of them like sending material to Ukraine, but also like projects with the OSZE for customs, like with the neighboring countries of Ukraine, for sensitizing officials for this illicit trafficking. So this is... I'm sorry, I'm extending my time, but we've done so much. So.
Thank you very much. No, but we are really glad that the Federal Culture the Federal Office of Culture can do something with funding and with sending material. Before I open for your questions, I would like to address here on the panel one last question. And it is what I mentioned before. You are already mentioned that there is this possibility to give back objects, to re-import. But what happens after war and after natural disasters, after destruction, when there is nothing more there on a site or nothing more from a monument? How does the reconstruction of cultural sites work, of cultural heritage work? And here, you already mentioned the symbolic value of cultural property before and restitution, but what else can be done when destruction was total? Maybe, Julia, we could start with you.
Sorry, one moment. Yeah. When after the shock, when it's destroyed, actually, somehow you are trying to get the team and you are trying to save something, because it's never that it's totally destroyed. There was something left, and so it's a chance to save the things and to keep them. And I know the several initiatives which self-organized very quickly in a way and with a goal to make the digital, to make the photos of the places, and also trying to make 3D scanning of the places that later it will be the possibility to rebuild or to reconstruct the things. Also, there are groups who are trying really to say what is left of such a places and move it to more safe places. All these people are working really in very difficult circumstances. And it's really big help and big support from all the countries, from the Switzerland, also from Germany, also from the Poland, also from all the countries, and also from many other countries who are trying to help with the materials and help us with the knowledges how to save this thing. Sometimes we are lack of the people, because you know, part of the people are now left Ukraine, and for example, half of my team are not in Kyiv, so we have double job for all who left in Kyiv now. At the same time, I think that this is a good chance for them to get the new knowledge and then come back and to implement this knowledge in museum. But again, this is technologies like scanning, like fixing the damages and trying to make the documentation for the further, to save the information later. I'm art historian, and I don't like very much 3D technology, sorry. I know that it's important very much, to fix a memory and to fix everything and for the research, but it never will replace a real object. And I do believe that somehow we could prevent the damages of the objects instead of building them later 3D models of the new one.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You are in a very dangerous situation and very challenging situation now. And what is impressive to me is not only to see your resilience of all the people working in museum and cultural sites in the Ukraine, but also to realize how you are really already trying to reconstruct during war, which is really, really an incredible challenge that you have. And also when you mentioned that the audience, the public in Ukraine has this need to go back to the museums, it stresses out how important the connection to culture is and how important your work is now in the Ukraine, trying to already not only prevent cultural heritage to get destroyed, but already to be in charge of reconstructing memory during war. So thank you very much for your engagement. I don't know, Maria or Tanya, do you want to add something to that?
Thank you, Julia. Thank you, Julia, for your comments. Really, I would just like to add that you were speaking about how important it is right now to suggest to ask people to go to the museums to celebrate culture, to try and have a normal life in a very difficult situation. So I would like to add to that. UNESCO is planning to create a culture hub in Lviv in the beginning of 2023. It will be a culture hub devoted to many different kinds of heritage. In this culture hub, we are planning to also to implement activities for culture professionals, capacity building workshops, and also trainings for, as you mentioned, very, very important, workshops for police and customs. Also with partners like the National Institute of Cultural Heritage of Poland, who have like very specific knowledge on the cultural heritage from Ukraine, so that police and customs can also learn about the specificities of the cultural heritage from the region. So we really try to do our best to initiate projects to bring back a cultural life in Ukraine. And just to give very shortly an example of what UNESCO can do for the post-conflict situations, to rebuild communities, rebuild cultural heritage, I think that a very good example would be what we are doing right now in Iraq, in Mosul. It's a project called Revive the Spirit of Mosul, which was launched in 2018 and has three main pillars, which is protecting heritage, cultural life, and education. Just to give you some numbers, we have managed to rehabilitate over 100 historical buildings. We have also created over 3,000 local jobs, which is very important for the communities. Also taking into account that 30% of engineers are women, very important too. And also we have over 50,000 people have benefited from awareness raising campaigns on the protection of cultural heritage. So this is a very good example, I think, on how to build peace and increase resilience of societies through cultural heritage and the involvement of communities and youth.
Thank you very much.
I would just like to add something talking about celebrating culture, and I just want to make a little commercial for an exhibition by which has also been a project of, funded by us, and it's in the Kunstzeughaus Rapperswil, and it is actually a very interesting story behind, because it's the works of 42 internationally renowned Ukrainian artists, like present artists, and this exhibition was shown in the exhibition at the art center Silkeborg in Denmark, and then it was supposed to go back to the Ukraine, but then because it was all before the war started. So then it couldn't go back. So it kind of, it was, this exhibition was homeless. So in a way you could say it was homeless and was searching for other places that it can be shown. And so at the moment it's the Kunsthochhaus in Rapperswil that they're showing these works. And they have also taken this opportunity because, of course, the exhibition, it was about landscapes, and but somehow the core also changed because, like, in this new context, the whole exhibition has now a new context, and these works are being shown until, I think, more or less the end of November, if I'm correct. So, but just maybe if somebody wants to celebrate Ukrainian culture, so you can go and see this exhibition. So,
thank you for this information, Tanya. Now I would like to open for your questions, and please raise your hand if you have a question and wait for the microphone so that also Julia can hear your question. Thank you. Question? Yeah.
Thank you. It's a very simple question. What I observed is that in the beginning, all of you were speaking about cultural heritage, and then you ended up talking about cultural property. So what is the difference?
It's a very pertinent question. In fact, cultural heritage is a much broader term. When I say cultural property, it's because when it comes to illicit trafficking and when it comes to the terms of the 1970 convention that we mentioned before, we do speak about cultural property. But cultural heritage is much broader. It can also encompass intangible cultural heritage sites, so it's much broader. I don't know if maybe Tanya wants to compliment.
Julia, do you want to ask something to that question?
Well, I think I agree that actually it's about the property is something usually more movable, and it's something which is could be moved maybe. But the heritage is all together. It's a property, it's a story, it's a people, it's a place, it's landscape, which mentioned Tanya. It's many other things which are connected in one nice picture, if you will. And if you will erase it, you will erase actually the whole picture. Property, it may be something which you could calculate. Heritage may be impossible to calculate.
Thank you very much. Yes, I really think cultural heritage is much more, and all that it's also all that what is implied when you are a person confronting yourself with your own culture and with the past. And other questions from the audience?
Thank you. I have a question to Julia Vaganova, if I may. Thank you very much for this evening. I highly appreciate that you support the awareness about cultural heritage in danger. And Julia Vaganova, you talked about the role of museums in protecting, in evacuating, in saving cultural heritage, and you talked about the role of museums in documenting what is going on and what has been lost already. And I want to ask you, is your museum, or do you know about other institutions who are also collecting at the time now being? I mean, collecting items of the ongoing war for future memory, or is that something you just can't because of capacities you don't have?
I see. Thank you for the question. Unfortunately, I cannot see because it's a camera on the scene. We are working with the documentation of the processes which are going in our museum, and we see it as a valuable historical document in the future. So we're making photos, we make small videos, we are writing, we are trying to document what is going on inside the museum during this last more than half a year. So some other institutions, for example, also trying to reflect in the same way. For example, the institution when I used to work before, Mestecky Art Museum, made the exhibition, which was an exhibition about our feelings, where the participants took and actually staff and team of this institution reflect and tell their stories of the first 3-4 months after the first 3 months, actually. Other institutions are really collecting the new objects. For example, I know that the Maidan Museum, which was organized after the Revolution of the Dignity in 2014, the director, the Igor Pashavala, he's very active in collecting the new items for the next exposition and for the next story. And I'm pretty sure that there are several museums. I'm sure that in Dnipro, there are also active people who are collecting the items for the new stories. I'm sure that in Chernihiv, they already have done the small exhibition with the items which was found and which left after the invasion. So yeah, museums are working on collecting new items because most of them or part of them had an experience during the Revolution of the Dignity and they understood the value of such objects and to collecting them right now.
Thank you, Julia, and I will maybe stick to this topic just for a moment more, and then I get back to the audience. You also told me when we spoke before the panel that you have organized exhibitions this summer outside of the Ukraine, and this is also a way of raising awareness for culture, Ukrainian culture. Can you maybe say something about that, these projects?
Actually, yes, I was waiting for the moment to mention about it. Actually, I would like to mention it because of two things. It was my really, I was really shocked when I, because I don't know all stories of the cities all over the world, when I heard the story about the Dortmund, where the exhibition is. That this is a city which actually is an absolutely new one, or maybe not 100% new, but very new, because it was bombed and almost erased during the Second World War. And curator of the exhibition, Barbara Vetsu, who invited us and proposed the idea of the exhibition, tell me the story about the city and how it's difficult, actually, after such an erasure, to rebuild the memory and to find the connection to the old memory again and again, because there is nothing. That's why it really shocked me very much. And it's really the very sad experience and very sad story. And I'm sure that there are more other such cities, but this is an example which we have keep in our mind. And in other things, which was very supportive to us and touched us very much, that we were proposed to make the exhibition with photos of empty museum. And when I asked Barbara why actually photos of the empty museum, and there was a brilliant answer also, that this is something when you feel fragility, but it's not destroyed for the moment. So you have something to save. You have this feeling that it could be saved, and you have this feeling that actually it was to be saved. So this exhibition was presented in the university where Barbara is working, and we are very thankful for this experience. And now the part of this exhibition and the photo from this exhibition will go also a little bit in another format, but also will be presented in Berlin in November, I guess. So this is another part of how we could be supported, how we could talk about ourselves and about our stories. Thank you, Barbara. I know that you are in a there.
Do you maybe want to say something about the project? Because this is really a coincidence. It wasn't planned. Barbara is here in the context for 3 days in Zurich in the context of a congress about textiles. And then we just discovered that, yeah, that you had a project together. I don't know if you want to add something.
Yes, of course. Hi, Julia. It's so wonderful to see you. I want to add two things. One thing is, I think it's important, beside all the important things you said this evening, that it matters to us. That's what you said. That's the convention of Faro. It's one humankind, and it's our shared heritage. So it matters to us. And Julia, you can't see the audience here, about 50 persons of different ages, and they are really, really listening. And I just say it, it matters. And I think we should tell this. We do it, but we didn't communicate it. And the other thing is, and we talked a lot about that, is that we don't have to talk about Ukraine only in the ways of robbery, of destruction, and so on. We have to talk about that, and we have to document that. And I bring another term into it, because this kind of systematic targeting is a genocide. And nothing smaller. But we have to talk about the hope, and that's what I learned from you, Julia, that you always... We made a first text to that exhibition about a museum in waiting or something like that. And you corrected it and said it's a museum in expectation and hope. So.
Thank you, Maria.
Thank you very much. Erasing memory, hope, reconstructing. These are really all very important topics, themes, words, and as you said, as you both said, it is cultural heritage, it has to do with the cultural heritage of whole humanity, and it is connected to us. It is even very physical connected to us, also in the example of the Ukraine, because of even people that come from my region have constructed there, have designed a part also of what Ukraine is today. We have time for one last question from the audience, if there is one, and then I have one last question for you on the panel.
Thank you. I was wondering if in these international agreements or regulations, there is any kind of mention or recognition of special protection for the people who work in museums or in archaeological sites, because in the situation of conflict, they are particularly endangered. And I remember that in Iraq, the situation was critical and very serious for the people who work in these historical sites. And I wonder if there is any mention or if the situation of these people remains in the scope of humanitarian law exclusively. Thank you.
Thank you for this. My microphone doesn't like me. Thank you for this very pertinent question. In fact, while UNESCO has, as I said before, a normative framework for the protection of culture in all its forms and aspects, when it comes to the protection of the people working in museums, unfortunately, this is rather covered by human rights. Of course, for museums specifically, there is a recommendation which was adopted by the UNESCO General Conference in 2015 about the role of museums in society. And of course, it mentions the role of the community, the role of museum professionals, but the text of the recommendation doesn't cover the museum professionals themselves. But of course, whenever we implement an activity, whenever we go to the field, whenever we are providing technical assistance to museum professionals, we really take into account their well-being and their circumstances, which are very hard. We know that right now the situation for museum professionals in Ukraine is really, really hard. So we were even thinking about the possibility of providing grants in the framework of the UNESCO Emergency Group of Museums that Denise knows very well because the National Museum of Switzerland is part of it. Thank you very much again for being part of it. So we were hesitating about the possibility of providing grants, fellowships, scholarships to museum professionals from Ukraine. So we'll see if in the future this is possible too. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So because of the time, we have to come to the last question. I want to ask you, just try to answer in 2 minutes. I just want to ask you for a final statement. What would you like to tell to the audience today as a final statement on cultural heritage and the importance of what we have heard today? Maybe starting by Julia.
Thank you. Thank you, first of all, for inviting me, and thank you for this discussion. I could only say that all the cultural heritage, they're interconnected. And when the cultural heritage is destroyed in one country, it means that it's destroyed in your country too. Sorry for this direct connection. Because, for example, a museum which I'm working for, this museum of Asian and Western European art, and loss of the something in the museum, it will lose the part of your culture as well. As well as the loss of the Ukrainian culture, it will affect the gaps in the world culture. The only thing, actually, to work with it, it's really to talk and to stop the war. This is not the conflict, this is the real war. And also to pay attention to the people who are working in the museum, because they make great things. And I'm talking not about myself and my team, but about the people who are really on the east of Ukraine and working now there, because they're under attack and they, unfortunately, in danger, in physical dangers every day. And to save the life of the people and save the life from the museum, of the museum professionals, this is also what is important to do. Otherwise, we lost not only the heritage, but also the knowledge how to research this heritage. And humanitarian law, unfortunately, doesn't work in these places. And unfortunately, doesn't work also any convention. And I do believe that only the solidarity of the museums and solidarity of the democratic countries, sorry for my pathetic, but I do believe in it, could stop this war. Thank you for your support, and thank you for standing with Ukraine.
Thank you very much, Julia, for your statement. Tanya?
Just very quickly, and I think I want to pick up what you said, that it's really, that it matters. So it really matters, and cultural heritage matters, and I really think that it's important to raise awareness and to keep the awareness also high, because people start to get numb after a while. It just happens, and this is what I really think. It's because with Ukraine, I mean, the war is still going on, and I think this is what really, we have to keep it up, the work. So this is what, I think my final words. So.
Thank you very much, Maria.
Thank you. I think that what I would like to say is that we really admire you. We really respect your work from there in very, very extremely difficult circumstances. So just to underline what my colleagues said, and also what Barbara said, heritage matters, and UNESCO really stands ready to assist in any way, to keep providing capacity building workshops, even online, to train customs, train police in neighboring countries, to keep supporting the efforts of cultural heritage professionals from Ukraine. So we really stand ready to provide any support you may need. And thank you so much for everything.
Thank you, Maria, and thank you to all of you for your interest, for having been here. One of the questions that really stays with me every day since the beginning of the war in the Ukraine is, what can we do as the Swiss National Museum? We cannot be there. We cannot come to you, Julia. We cannot go to Syria, but we can speak about it. We can raise awareness, and we can try to help in writing also about it in our blog of the museum. We try also to explain the connection between Switzerland and Ukraine. As I mentioned before, in the 18th and 19th century, many Swiss people emigrated and to the Caucasus and also to many territories that are part of the Ukraine today. So cultural heritage has really something to do with all of us. It matters. And it is important to speak about it. So thank you very much for having been here today. Thank you, Julia Vaganova. Thank you, Tania Esposito. Thank you, Maria Jose Miñana. It was very important, your presence here today. I'm very thankful for that. Yes, and the next the next panel in the series of History Talks will take place on the 14th of November. It will be a complete different topic. It will have to do with our temporary exhibition about the Baroque. And we will speak with Bice Kuriger, Werner Höchslin, and Juri Steiner in the auditorium of the Landesmuseum here. So I hope to see you then. And thank you for being here, and have a nice evening.